15-5217, American Civil Liberties Union et al. Appellants v. United States Department of Justice et al. Mr. Jafar for the appellants, Ms. Swingle for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, I'm Jamil Jaffer for the appellants. As you know, Your Honors, this case involves a six-year-old FOIA request for records concerning the government's drone program. The Court rejected the CIA's Glomar response in 2013. Since then, three important things have happened. First, senior officials, including the President, have continued to speak publicly about drone strikes and about the purported legal basis for them. Second, another appeals court, the Second Circuit, has held that the CIA has acknowledged an operational interest in drone strikes, and it has ordered the government to publish certain of its legal analysis. And third, plaintiffs have substantially narrowed the FOIA request at issue here to focus on only two categories of records, legal memos and what we're calling summary strike data. As we explained in our briefs, the district court abused its discretion in declining to review those two categories of records in camera. But even if the district court did not abuse its discretion, there are compelling reasons why this court should now review both the CIA's classified declaration and at least a sample of the records in camera for itself.
See, but on that argument, actually on both of your arguments about official disclosure and the need to review our obligation to review the underlying documents, you know, our case law just seems contrary to that. Our cases are pretty clear that in national security areas, if the affidavit demonstrates that the information logically falls within the classification and is not contradicted by any contrary evidence, we aren't supposed to look at the underlying documents. That's what our case law says. I'm actually pretty curious about some of these, but our case law says we aren't supposed to do it. In fact, one of them says just we shouldn't do it, quote, just to make sure. So let's start with that. That's this circuit's law.
Well, so Judge Tatel, I share your curiosity about those cases.
Yeah, okay.
But we're not taking on that case law here.
But let me just ask you a very specific question, okay? Okay. I've looked at the government's affidavit, its classified affidavit. We're not going to talk about it today, but I've looked at it. Now, if I think, having looked at it, that and I'm quoting here, logically falls within the exemption and is not contradicted, but or there's any agency bad faith, if I look at the affidavit and reach that conclusion, what's the basis for this court looking further and actually getting the documents? That's the question.
Well, Judge Tatel, I think that this is not just an unusual case, but arguably a unique case,
right?
For a number of different reasons.
Right.
One is that this court has already rejected some of the CIA's representations in this case as illogical and implausible.
Okay, but that was only on the question of acknowledgement, right? That didn't relate to the documents.
No, but
that's
true. It's a different question.
Yeah.
But the point is that the CIA's representations turned out not to be well-founded. That's the only point I'm trying to make, and I think that that's just a fair description of the court's previous ruling.
Uh-huh.
And then if you look at the Second Circuit's ruling, which came after this court's May of 2013 ruling, the Second Circuit found essentially the same thing.
Right, but they have a different standard, too. This brings me back to circuit law. And I'm just, you know, we have to act within these standards. And it's the Second Circuit seems to have a much more forgiving standard. Our case law says the disclosed materials has to match.
Well, that's on official acknowledgement, Your Honor.
Well,
I actually don't think that the standard.
No, I'm
just talking about the circumstances in which an appeals court or a district court should look at a, a, look at the documents in camera.
Second Circuit standard. Oh, so your theory is because another circuit looked at it and found some problems, but that's enough for us to look at it.
It may not be enough in itself, but that put together with this court's previous ruling, add to that the fact that the government continues to talk publicly about the very subject matters that are addressed in these documents, add to that the public interest in the records, which I think is extraordinary in this case. I think all of those are good reasons why this court ought to look at the underlying.
Generally speaking, about the same subject matter is not enough to constitute an official disclosure, is it, counsel?
No, you're absolutely right, Judge Sento, but that's not the argument I'm making. I'm making an argument about the circumstances in which a court should look at the documents itself. I'm not making an argument about official acknowledgement. I'm just arguing.
How does that fact that there has been public discussion of the general subject matter change the circuit law to which the presiding judge is referring? We're still not supposed to look at it if the affidavit appears to be enough on its face, are we?
No, I don't think that's a fair reading of this circuit's law. I don't think that this circuit has been that categorically has categorically ruled out a court. There's a question of when the government.
In the case when we looked at the affidavit, found the affidavit on its face to be sufficient, and yet still went and looked at documents.
Well, there's certainly multiple cases in which this court has found, or at least the district courts have found, evidence of bad faith, and on that basis looked at the affidavit. And this court has made clear that in those circumstances, looking at the documents is justified.
Wait, but I think we're confusing two different issues. Maybe I was responsible for it by jumping into official acknowledgement. But aren't there two steps to this? Step one is we look at the affidavit, the classified affidavit, and if we think it's sufficiently precise and convincing, then under the circuit law, we don't go any further. Then there's a second question, which is even if it is properly excludable under the freedom under Exemption 1, then there's a second question of whether or not, even so, there's been official disclosure, right?
That's right.
Those are two different questions.
Right. That's right.
So let's keep them separate for purposes of argument. So the fact that something might have been, according to your theory, officially disclosed does not affect the first question. Correct?
Well, that's right, Your Honor. I think the first question precedes
the
second.
So let me go back to my question then. If I've looked at the affidavit, and I'm starting the sentence with an if, because I'm not telling you what I think, but if I think that it meets the standard, that is, that it logically falls within the exemption and there's no bad faith in there, then what's the basis for the court looking further? Not official acknowledgement,
right,
but this question.
No, I understand the question, Judge Tatel, and my answer, I'm sorry, will repeat some of what
said
already, but I think that the circumstances presented here are very different than the circumstances that were presented in all of the cases the government is relying on. Here we have a situation where this court has already found that some of the CIA's representations in this case were unfounded. The Second Circuit found the same thing, and it bears emphasis, Judge Tatel, that in the Second Circuit, the government said precisely what it's saying here, that nothing could be segregated from the classified information. And when the Second Circuit looked at the underlying documents, it found to the contrary.
So how do those facts affect the test we're supposed to apply? Does that mean that they don't logically fall within the exemption? Or does it mean that the government's acting in bad faith? Because those are the questions we're supposed to ask when we're looking at the classified affidavit, right?
Well,
as far as I know, we're not supposed to be looking at these other factors, like the Second Circuit did with it, or what a previous court did.
We're supposed to look,
as I understand it, and maybe I'm wrong, correct me on it, as I understand it, we're looking at the classified affidavit. If we believe, as a result of that the material logically falls within the exemption, and that there's no bad faith, our case law tells us no in-camera review of that document. Now,
I don't think that's right, Judge Griffith. So first, I think it's important.
You don't think what's right? Well, just a minute.
I don't think that the case.
I understand your premise here.
I don't think that the case law precludes this court or precluded the district court from looking at the documents. The case law addresses the circumstances when it's an abuse of discretion not to look at the documents, right? So, but that question of whether it's an abuse of discretion is different from the one I'm addressing now, because my argument is that even if it wasn't an abuse of discretion for the district court not to look at the underlying documents, it's entirely open to this court to look at the underlying documents. And some of this court's cases actually suggest that it should.
That's not what our cases say. Which case are you quoting? Tell me a case.
Well, the cases that the government is citing are all cases involving a situation where the question was whether the district court abused its discretion in failing to look.
But what's the case your proposition that we can, in the face of a district court decision, not to look at the documents? And if we read the classified affidavit and conclude that the material logically falls within the exemptions, not in bad faith, what's the case that says, under those circumstances, we can nevertheless look at the document in camera? That's what I'm looking
right.
for.
Right. So one answer to that, and I recognize the incompleteness of this answer, is that the Second Circuit did precisely that in New York Times versus DOJ, right? But in
I'm
this court,
for our case.
Right? No, I understand.
I'm looking for our case.
Right.
With
so
all due respect to the Second Circuit, I'm looking
just
for.
Just forget our about the Second.
That's what I meant, but.
You can forgive the Ninth while you're at it.
You know, I don't think that even the government has argued here, I mean, I certainly didn't see it in its brief, that this court doesn't have the authority to look at the underlying documents. You know, the court has the authority to look at the underlying documents. The only thing that is foreclosed, the only thing that this court's case law says on this point is that the court has to give substantial weight. That's the phrase that the court uses over and over. Substantial weight to the agency's declaration. And I think that makes sense in the ordinary case. And maybe it makes sense here, too, to give substantial weight to the CIA's affidavit. But the CIA's affidavit isn't the only thing before the court. There are many other things that have happened in this case that are relevant to the question of whether the court should look at the underlying documents. So my argument is just that the court isn't foreclosed from looking at those documents. I don't think the government is arguing to the contrary. And I understand.
You don't know a case from our circuit where
the court actually did look at the underlying documents. I don't, Your Honor.
Okay,
I don't.
The question of whether we're foreclosed is a different question than whether we're compelled.
That's right,
You're
Your
saying
Honor.
We would be wrong not to look.
I'm saying that there are compelling reasons to look, and there is no jurisdictional or other bar to your looking.
If the agency has, I'm reading from one of our cases, if the agency has met its burden through an affidavit, in-camera review is neither necessary nor appropriate. That's a quote. D.C. Circuit.
Your Honor, the question of whether
neither
the agency
appropriate,
has...
Neither necessary nor appropriate. That tells me we're not supposed to look at it, and as I understand our case law, you know, this is all sort of caught up in the principles enunciated by this court that when it comes to questions of national security, judges were supposed to review this stuff, these materials deferentially and not second guess it. And so our prior precedent seems to have limited the ability of the court to go beyond the government's assurances in a specific affidavit.
Well, so, Your Honor, two points on that. The first is that I think the first half of the sentence you read is at least as important as the second half. When the agency has met its burden, I'm not sure if I'm quoting directly.
But you see, my question was all, the question is all, every question I've asked you is linked to the very first one I asked you, which is assume that I've looked at it and found it sufficiently specific to plausibly justify the argument that these documents are properly classified and exempt. That's part of my hypothetical, okay? Then it says, and what you and I have been talking about is, well, under what circumstances can I go further and look at the documents? And this case says I can't. So what I'm looking for from you is what other indicators might prompt us to take an affidavit that otherwise meets the standard and have a list of documents. Now, one of your arguments is, I get one of your arguments. Your argument, I gather, is that since this circuit and the Second Circuit have rejected agency arguments about some documents, that should make us a little more suspicious about the affidavit we've read, right?
That's correct.
That's one argument. Is there any other?
You know, our Yes, Your Honor. The other argument is that the government has been speaking publicly about these topics.
What about bad faith? I mean, if you're going to look at what we've said about this before, bad faith is an exception to it. But you're not alleging bad faith, are you?
Well, I suppose if it's important to put that label on the argument I just made, if that makes a difference, then yes.
That's the language from our cases, and you're not using it, and I'm wondering why.
Well, I didn't understand the cases to be saying that only in circumstances of bad faith is it appropriate or possible for the court to look at the underlying documents. And for that reason, we haven't packaged it in that way.
Okay.
But the other thing I wanted to say in response to Judge Tatel's question is that the agency appears to have applied the wrong standard. Even if you've read the affidavit, and the affidavit says, we've looked at these documents, and none of them can be disclosed. The agency appears to have applied the wrong standard in two different respects. One is on official acknowledgement. We think that they have applied a much more rigid standard than even this court has accepted in the past. And the second is that the government...
In what respect? I mean, our standard is unbelievably strict. It says it must match.
It does, Your Honor, but
that test
comes out of Afshar, I think, initially. Fitzgibbon took it from Afshar. And Afshar uses the phrase different in some material respect.
Yeah, but our later cases are much more specific than Afshar. They're much tighter. Those cases, our later cases are a lot tighter than that.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the
they say it must be a match.
But there's this question of what counts as a match. I mean, what if the period is in one place rather than another? I don't think this court would say, well, that's not a match. Uh-huh. You need to have some governing principle to decide what counts as a match and what doesn't. Uh-huh. And I think Afshar provides a governing principle. But I want to just get – I'm running out of time. I want to get out the other distinction or the other answer to your question, Judge Tatel. And you would ask, if you look at the affidavits and you find that the affidavits say that everything falls within the exemption – the other respect in which the government appears to have applied the wrong standard is that the government's theory seems to be that anything that pertains to, in some broad sense, sources and methods is withholdable under Exemption 1. And it's true that the executive order uses the phrase pertains to, but it's not our view that anything that touches on or relates to, even remotely, a source or method is withholdable.
Well, again, you run into this circuit's case law. We've said that is, quote, not a demanding standard.
Well, Your Honor, it may not be a demanding standard, but legal analysis that is not entwined with sources and methods, that can be disentangled from sources and methods, doesn't meet that standard.
You're working at a disadvantage. You haven't seen the affidavit. But suppose the affidavit demonstrates convincingly that that's not the case.
Well, it's hard to imagine how the affidavit could demonstrate that, given that government seems to be...
Suppose it does.
Well, I suppose if the affidavit demonstrates it so convincingly that the court is convinced that looking at the documents could not possibly change its mind, then, I suppose that the court should rule for the government.
Yeah.
But, if it leaves any question whatsoever, and I would say any question whatsoever, the court should look at the underlying documents.
Again, our case law said. That's why I'm asking you all these questions, because in terms of our ability to look at the record, at the underlying record, what official acknowledgement means, what the word pertain means, we have very clear circuit law on all this.
And Your Honor,
all my questions are aimed at getting you to help me understand how your case can prevail under those standards.
Your Honor, even if you accept the government's theory of pertains to, so that anything that even remotely touches on source or method can be withheld under exemption, under that particular aspect of Exemption 1, you're still left with the question of harm, whether the disclosure of legal analysis that is not entwined with properly classified sources and methods.
Let me ask you an unrelated, well, maybe it's related. Is a drone strike an intelligence source or method?
I don't think that the drone strike itself is an intelligence source or method. I don't take the government to be arguing that. I take the government's argument to be that disclosing the kind of information we've asked for would tend to reveal, and I think they use that phrase in their affidavit, in their public affidavit, tend to reveal sources and methods.
But I read your brief is at least in principle agreeing with that, correct? In other words, that a particular drone strike, information about a particular drone strike such as target, place, sources of information, could in fact reveal intelligence methods and sources. Correct?
Well, I think it would depend on the information in question, but I think that the emphasis in our brief is not on that, but rather on the harm.
And doesn't the executive order speak more broadly than that, so that it's anything that pertains to intelligence activities and not just sources and methods? And if that's the case, don't the strikes pertain to intelligence activities?
Judge Griffith, I don't want to get, I mean, I think we were left with the same question about the breadth of the phrase pertains to, but I don't want to get hung up on it because ultimately you're still left with the question of harm, right? Even if the government is correct that all of this falls into one of the classification categories, the government can withhold information under the executive order only if it can also show that disclosure would result in harm. And given
so
all
are you conceding then at least the first part of it? That
we're not conceding it.
The summary of strike activity, you say, does not pertain to intelligence activities?
It would depend on the information in the specific information question, and there's also this. You have to see all this against the background of the government's own disclosure. So whether it would disclose
there are lots of layers of analysis right here. I'm just focusing on one, and that is whether the drone strikes pertain to intelligence activities.
If you set aside,
that's the first step in a long inquiry. I think
that we concede that if there hadn't been any disclosures at all, and the government were just arguing about the pertaining to prong, yes.
Okay. Yeah. That's helpful.
Well, you have to, for the purposes of this, you have to ignore whether there's been any disclosures or not. The purpose is just very quick.
On that prong of the exemption line analysis,
that's not the end of the inquiry, but that's the beginning of it.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sharon Swingle from the Department of Justice for the CIA.
Can I start where we just left off here?
I was just hoping to do that, Your Honor. And I want to point out,
what do you think my question was going to be?
Well, I was going to start with Judge Griffiths, but I would like to start with yours, Judge Taylor, if you would.
No, start with mine.
You start with his.
Your Honor correctly pointed out what is the government's position, which is that a drone strike would, in fact, be an intelligence activity, and I did not understand counsel to object to that. What I heard him say is that the court would have to decide, nevertheless, whether the government had shown a demonstrable or identifiable harm. But I want to be clear, the ACLU not only did not argue in district court that we had not made that showing, they explicitly declined to challenge that, and that's at plaintiff's opposition. It's ECF 69, page 25, note 31. So I think that in itself resolves the question.
How can a drone strike to kill a particular person be an intelligence activity? That sounds like military to me.
Well, and to the extent it's not an intelligence activity, to be clear, Judge Tatel, we also invoked 1.4D.
I got your back. I understand your argument that just to reveal it would reveal intelligence methods, right?
I understand that.
But is an actual drone strike used to kill a person in and of itself an intelligence activity?
Our position is that, yes, it is, and that process discloses information.
I thought your argument was that it pertains to intelligent activities.
I think we have several arguments in response.
Is one of them what Judge Griffith just said?
One of them is that it pertains to intelligence activities.
Because the CIA used intelligence to identify the target?
Because the question of who the intended target is, who is actually killed, what their status is, the identity of the agency doing it, the location of the strike, the date, this all reveals very sensitive
information reporting what they know after the strike and what they knew before the strike.
Exactly, Your Honor, and how that might change over time. I mean, I think
I think I have to be a little skeptical of saying that the strike in itself is intelligence activity, but it would pertain both before and after.
Well, I do think even if it isn't an intelligence activity, it is a foreign activity, but in any event, you're right, in our view, it pertains to because it concerns or relates to intelligence activities, sources, and methods, and so it would nevertheless be covered. And I think this court's prior decisions have essentially accepted that broader view of what the classification authority is. There are multiple cases that uphold the withholding of information under Exemption 1 where its disclosure would tend to reveal or would reasonably tend to reveal intelligence sources and methods. So I think that's foreclosed by this court's precedent. In the main, I think the ACLU's argument here is that because the government has, over the course of time, made voluntary disclosures of previously classified information in order to increase public transparency and knowledge of what is obviously a controversial program, that somehow different legal standards should apply here. And with all due respect...
No, I think we sorted that out. I don't think they're arguing that. I think they're arguing... Well, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I think... I thought we sorted that out, that there's two separate questions. First is whether it's properly withheld, and then the second, has there been disclosure?
I think that is the correct way,
okay,
certainly, to
and
look at it.
And with respect to that, what about their argument that they say the Lutz affidavit that we've been relying on, both the unclassified and the classified one, that predates the plaintiff's list of disclosures. They've got this long chart in their brief. It's at blue 44 to 52. And their point is that we have an affidavit from Lutz saying there hasn't been any official disclosure, but Lutz didn't look at any of this.
I don't believe that's correct, Judge Tatel. I will say, if I can, a couple of things.
You think the Lutz...
So she did not see the list, but I don't think it was any surprise what public statements the ACLU was relying on as constituting the official disclosures. Of course...
How would we know that?
Well, she says in her affidavit, in the public affidavit and in the classified affidavit, that she has reviewed...
Could you tell us anything she says in the classified affidavit?
You don't want to say that. That's a good point.
But just to be clear...
The forum's not sealed at the moment.
Yes.
Tell us, deal only with the public affidavit. Your opposition hasn't seen that.
That's right, Your Honor. But as to this precise issue, I think both declarations are clear, but I'm not going to get into classified information here, obviously, but she says that she has reviewed both the Second Circuit's ruling, which obviously outlines a number of the public disclosures that they rely on here.
I understand that.
And
here's
the
question I have for you. If I look at the affidavit, well, I've looked at it, will I find in that affidavit that, true, this list from the ACLU in its brief comes after affidavit? But if I look at that affidavit, will it show me that she actually looked at those so-called disclosures?
It does not.
Is that your point?
She says generally that she has looked at the public disclosures that have been made by the government in reaching the conclusion that the information is still properly
withheld. But how do we know that they're the public disclosures listed in the brief here?
She does not delineate which ones it is.
But that's my whole point. Let's just suppose, for example, hypothetically, okay, that it's very clear that she looked at, say, a dozen public disclosures, and the ACLU's brief identifies two more. What would we do with that?
If I may, Your Honor, I think I would separate out kind of the affidavit itself and the legal question for this court about the status of various disclosures. Obviously, the district court looked at what was the equivalent list provided by the ACLU before this court and said that the kind of highly generalized public statements relied on by the ACLU were, you know, worlds different from the specific granular details sought in its request.
So your point is that it's not a problem because just looking at the ACLU, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but those are the same types of disclosures.
That's right,
Generic
Your Honor.
Disclosures.
I don't see this
that don't meet our standard.
This is not a factual...
So we don't need an affidavit for that. That's
we do
point.
Not, Your okay. Honor. And I think the existing right. affidavit clearly right. and adequately supports the withholdings on that respect.
Right. Let me take you on to another thing that concerns me. I understand your argument in our case law that if the affidavit is sufficiently specific and gives a plausible explanation of why these materials are properly covered by the exemption, by the executive order, that we don't go look at the affidavits. I got that. But what about the segregability part of it? I mean, how can a court know that there isn't information in these documents that could be disclosed without looking at them? How do we know that? I mean, I know, you know, let's, you know, assuming total good faith, on the part of the person who writes the affidavit. She concludes that, you know, I've looked at them and it's all intertwined and they're not segregable. How does the court exercise its responsibility without looking at the documents?
If I can provide a few answers, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I think first, you know, obviously the segregability analysis here is affected by the fact that we invoked not only Exemption 1 protection for these documents, but also Exemption 3 and Exemption 5. And because the documents, in our view, and as supported by the Lutz Declaration, are withholdable in their entirety as privileged documents, I think the question of segregability that the ACLU is arguing here doesn't really grapple with that issue.
Uh-huh.
I think second, yes, if the court was unable on the basis of the description of the documents in the two Lutz affidavits to make a ruling on segregability, I don't think we would take the position that the court couldn't look at the documents. The question is whether the court could reach that conclusion, and obviously here the district court found that there was no segregability to be done.
Well, the district court didn't look at the documents either.
The district court did not find it necessary to look at the documents. Obviously, there's a fairly detailed description of the various documents in the classified declaration think gives the court enough to rule on. And ultimately, this question of, you know, affidavits versus in-camera review, it's really a question of what the district court needs to assure itself that the documents have properly been withheld. And, you know, with all due respect, the court here found that it had enough from the government that it didn't need to undertake the process of in-camera review of the documents.
Yeah, but we review decisions of district courts. That's why we're here.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay. The question is that correct?
Right. But
And we're de novo.
That's right, Your Honor.
Deference.
And we don't,
so that doesn't help.
We don't disagree that if the court could not decide on the basis of the affidavits, it could look at the documents or potentially send it back. You know, obviously, the second category of documents here, the intelligence products, there were thousands of documents. They are described with some detail in the classified declaration. The district court didn't find it necessary to look at an example, but it had copious detail about, you know, the nature of those documents and what they contained.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an abuse of discretion? I think we would say certainly not. And I'm not even sure I understand the ACLU to be arguing that it's an abuse of discretion. Their argument appears to be that, and at one point in their argument, they embraced the bad faith label, that somehow because of the official disclosures that have been made over time, that different standards should apply.
What do we do with the fact that, I have a question about the white paper, which is one of the documents at issue here.
The classified white paper.
Yeah, right. A district judge here has already ruled that parts of that don't pertain and had to be disclosed. It's a different case, but, you know, is the fact that another federal judge looked at the same document and thought that, contrary to what the affidavit said, some of the materials didn't pertain to intelligence sources and activities, is that enough of a basis for us to say, gee, we ought to look a little further here to see if maybe that's true of these other documents?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. I think we have the district court here holding that that document was properly withheld in part.
This district court did not look at the document. Judge Maida did look at the document.
Right, and of course
he wasn't doing it just on the basis. He actually looked at the document.
That decision
and he said the government's wrong.
That decision is still pending.
Okay.
And
go ahead.
Why didn't government make the argument to Judge Maida that this issue is before the D.C. Circuit, so hold off? Why didn't the government make that argument there?
I'm not aware, Your Honor.
I found it astounding.
We do obviously think that decision is wrong.
It must not be a very important issue to you then. I mean, it's here, but it wasn't there.
We have sought reconsideration. Obviously, we do think it's an erroneous decision. I'm not aware whether they asked.
That's not the issue I'm saying. It would seem to me that the Justice Department should have gone to the district court and said, hold off on that issue. It's going to be before the D.C. Circuit in this case. And yet the government didn't do that.
I'm not aware whether the government did or didn't, Your Honor. I mean, obviously, we do think the document is withholdable. I would note that the district court in the Southern...
So you think the government might have made that argument there?
I honestly
you
do
don't
not know.
Know,
Your Honor. The Southern District of New York, you know, in the parallel
I don't care about the Southern District
also
of New York.
Upheld its withholding every day.
Yeah, yeah.
And the issue will
it's
then
the,
be
it's
before
the law of this case that know. We don't care about the Southern District. Judge Santel.
This obviously is a very complex set of cases to litigate because there are multiple parallel litigations involving partially overlapping sets of the same documents. You know, the ACLU has submitted multiple requests. So,
is that issue pending before? That's still in the district court on a motion for reconsideration, right?
Is that right? Mesa matter, yeah. Yes. There was an appeal filed of that ruling.
And we dismissed it or something.
Well,
right?
it's being held pending a decision on reconsideration. I assume that the court would then need to do, it will be an indicative ruling and a partial remand that Judge Mehta reconsiders. Right.
We've consumed all your, did you have anything else you wanted? I thought I heard you starting another sentence when I interrupted you. Anything?
No, Your Honor, certainly would not want to interrupt you. I guess just to make one final point, you. If I could, or a couple of quick frontal points before sitting down. Yeah. I just want to be clear, you know, the ACLU here has argued at great length that legal analysis can't properly be withheld, certainly after the Second Circuit earlier ruling that's their position. But, of course, the Second Circuit has now issued a second decision and a second appeal as to 10 OLC memoranda, 9 of which were withheld in their entirety. And that court itself has affirmed the withholding in their entirety of 9 OLC memoranda about this very subject. So even under that court's, I think, looser standards for withholding, the court has held that legal analysis memoranda can be upheld in their entirety.
Okay.
And then finally, on the working law issue, which the ACLU argues at length in its brief, first, you know, we think it's clearly waived. It was not preserved in the district court. Second, even they don't seem to argue, at least not in a robust way, that a working law theory would be a basis for overriding Exemption 1 protection. And then just to be clear, I think this court's EFF decision makes clear that working law is really understood properly as distinguishing between pre-decisional deliberative material, which is privileged and exempt under
All
5,
right. Okay.
And the other. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Did Mr. Jaffer have any more time? You can take 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of quick points. So first, just to respond to something that the government just said about characterizing our argument about legal analysis. In case there's any confusion about this, we are not arguing that legal analysis can't be withheld under Exemption 1. Our argument is that legal analysis can be withheld to the extent it is inextricably intertwined with classified facts. And that's entirely consistent with the Second Circuit's latest decision. It found that the legal analysis was intertwined with and it couldn't be disentangled from properly classified facts. If that's the case with the memos here, then the court should uphold their withholding. Second, I just wanted to, in a more systematic way, provide once again the factors that I think distinguish this case from all the other cases involving the question of whether in-camera review was appropriate. I'm just going to list them because we've already discussed most of them. One is the findings that this court has already made in this case with respect to the CIA's representations. Two is the Second Circuit made the same findings. Three is the timing of the government's affidavit and Judge Tatel. I'm glad that you brought that up just now. Again, it was filed. The government's affidavit was filed.
Do you have a rebuttal to the government's answer about the timing issue?
Well,
that's what you're supposed to be doing now. She made it
right. No, I understand, Judge Griffith. I didn't actually think that the government said anything that we hadn't already responded to. The government's position.
Why did you rise and rebuttal?
She did. She said that.
If you're not rebutting, you're not supposed to be up here.
She said that. Well, we can look at that list ourselves and see that they're the same types of generic statements that don't qualify.
So the government is making legal judgments in that case. The government is making a legal determination in its affidavit that this doesn't count as an official acknowledgement, this doesn't pertain to, and those kinds of things are things that the government isn't entitled to deference on.
Okay. So what's the end of your list?
And then finally, Judge, I just wanted to give you a cite for the proposition that, that bad faith isn't the only circumstance in which the court can look at documents in camera. King versus DOJ. It's 830 F. 2nd 210.
Our court?
Yes.
That's the D.C. Circuit.
Yeah,
what does
DC
it say?
Circuit.
What, tell us what it says.
So it lists factors that would justify a court looking at documents in camera.
What's the date of it? I didn't hear the date.
1987.
Okay, fine.
So then the last thing I'll say, Your Honor, is that if the court reaches the harm analysis, as we hope that it will, our view is that the harm analysis has to be informed by the fact that drone strikes themselves are not secret. They are, you know, people who witness them overseas every day. You know, it's not a secret to them. It's a secret, if it's a secret at all, only to us. The harm analysis also has to take into account the government's continuing disclosures about the program.
But you want more than just the fact of the drone strike. If it's already well known, that's not what you're here for. Looking for something that's already known, that is to say the fact of the drone strike.
That's right, Justin Tom. I'm not making official acknowledgement.
When you separate that from intelligence sources and methods, the government's position, I think I state correctly, would be that that which leads up to the drone strike and that which follows it involves sources and methods of intelligence.
Your Honor, I think that if you ask the government to justify its harm argument, it should have to explain why the incremental information that we're asking for, over and above the disclosures that the government has already made, would cause harm. That's my only point, that the disclosures the government has already made should count for something in the harm analysis. And at a certain point, and the court said this in its last opinion, at a certain point, the court has to recognize as true what everybody else recognizes as true. And the government shouldn't be able to shouldn't be permitted to keep claiming that all this is a secret.
All of this is where the problem comes in. The fact of the strike, you say, is not secret. But that's not what you're looking for. You already know that.
Your Honor, the things that the
documentation that surrounds the strike. Right?
That's right, Your Honor, but the government has disclosed not just the fact of the strike.
I'm keeping you up past your red light.
So. Okay, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. Call the next case, please. Let's take a 5-minute break and clear the courtroom and then come back. Good idea.